listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. The program is Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor. Praxis receives support from the Smith Barbieri Progressive Fund, a charitable foundation. Information at smith-barbieri.com. As I said, you're listening to Praxis. Today, I'm really excited to share an interview that I recorded earlier this morning with Loretta Ross. She is incredible. Her work has recently kind of come more fully to my attention when she was brought by the planning team of the International Women's Day celebration that took place a couple weeks ago here in Spokane as the keynote speaker. She's the founder of Sister Song, the National Center for Human Rights Education, and many other projects. And a lot of what she had to say really ties into things that I've been focusing on this show for the last year or more about building strong movements, building intergenerational, intercultural, multi-issue social movements. So I'm going to share a little bit of her bio with you, share that interview with you. It's about half an hour, so it's going to be the bulk of the show, and then go into some examples. She shares this framework that I love, that I've been talking with everyone I know about since I saw her talk two Saturdays ago, calling in versus calling out, and what that means, what that might mean for people organizing locally, what it means in families, what it means all over the board. So yeah, here's a little bit about Loretta Ross before we get the show going completely. Loretta J. Ross was a co-founder and the national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective from 2005 to 2012, a network founded in 1997 of women of color and allied organizations that organize women of color in the reproductive justice movement. She's one of the creators of the term reproductive justice, coined by African-American women in 1994 following the International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo, Egypt. She's a nationally recognized trainer on using the transformative power of reproductive justice to build a human rights movement that includes everyone. Ms. Ross is an expert on women's issues, hate groups, racism and intolerance, human rights, and violence against women. Her work focuses on the intersectionality of social justice issues and how this affects social change and service delivery in all movements. Ross has appeared on CNN, BET, Lead Story, Good Morning America, The Donahue Show, Democracy Now!, and The Charlie Rose Show. And now Praxis. She is a member of the Women Media Center's Progressive Women's Voices. More information is available in her Makers episode. I'm kind of skipping through her biography because it's a long one. As part of a four-decade history in social justice activism between 1996 and 2004, she was the founder and executive director of the National Center for Human Rights Education, NCHRE, in Atlanta, Georgia. Before that, she was the program research director at the Center for Democratic Renewal, National Anti-Klan Network, where she led projects researching hate groups and working against all forms of bigotry with universities, schools, and community groups. So she's going to talk a little bit more about that specific work in the interview that I'm going to play with you. And we skim over in the interview what exactly reproductive justice is. That's something else that I want to share. And this is a piece that Loretta herself wrote in 2006 that was updated in 2011 when a lot of other groups in, I guess, what we would understand as like the pro-choice movement started to use the term reproductive justice. So I want to share that because that was the original thought that I had to focus on in this interview with her. This is, you know, the very end now of Women's History Month, celebrating International Women's Day and all the rest, and looking at, you know, I've been really lucky to feature a lot of incredible women's voices, and I have more lined up for April about this. And I think that reproductive justice is an idea that's at the center of that. If we want as women to be able to organize effectively, we're going to need to have reproductive justice. So I'm going to read a little bit of this to you before I play that interview with Loretta. Since Sister Song nationally debuted the term reproductive justice at our first national conference in November 2003, the term has blossomed in the consciousness of the reproductive rights movement, including activists, funders, researchers, academics, and advocates. Many individuals, groups, and organizations find the term helpful in moving beyond the singular focus on abortion that dominates the pro-choice movement. People in other social justice movements find it useful in incorporating an understanding of reproductive health issues in organizations not primarily concerned with women's rights. It also provides a way to link groups concerned about sexual rights and gender identity issues with those working on reproductive issues. A Google search in November 2006 on the term produced 76,000 hits, proving the wide acceptance and usefulness for a term coined in 1994 by African-American women. According to Marlene Freed of the Civil Liberties and Public Policy Program at Hampshire College, reproductive justice provides a political home for a set of ideas, aspirations, and visions in language that encompasses all the social justice and human rights issues. Because of the popularity and viability of the term reproductive justice, Sister Song is concerned that people who use the term with our free and open permission understand what we mean by this language, because it is not merely a substitute for the terms pro-choice, reproductive rights, or even sexual rights. While we are encouraged at how quickly the term was adopted and adapted by so many allies in our movements, we hope that those who use the term fully appreciate its breadth, depth, and strength. This is why I wanted to share that. Reproductive justice is, in fact, a paradigm shift beyond demanding gender equality or attaching abortion rights to a broader reproductive health agenda. All of these concepts are, in fact, encompassed by the reproductive justice framework. Reproductive justice is an expansion of the theory of intersectionality developed by women of color and the practice of self-help from the Black women's health movement to the reproductive rights movement, based on the application of the human rights framework to the United States. Reproductive justice is, in essence, an intersectional theory emerging from the experiences of women of color whose multiple communities experience a complex set of reproductive oppressions. It is based on the understanding that the impacts of race, class, gender, and sexual identity oppressions are not additive but integrative, producing this paradigm of intersectionality. For each individual and each community, the effects will be different, but they share some of the basic characteristics of intersectionality: universality, simultaneity, and interdependence. So I'm going to share the rest of this later on in the interview. I just wanted to kind of ground it in a framework of what reproductive justice is. And I will link to this entire article and a lot of other resources in the podcast notes when I post that. So I think I'm going to dive into that interview, get things ready for the second half of the show. And I'd really welcome conversation on this interview. So if in the second half you want to call in, you can do that at 509-747-3807. Probably not until then, because the interview will be playing and I can't interrupt it to answer the phone. But I'd like to hear what people think of this, as, you know, we are having broader acceptance, broader integration of ideas like intersectionality, and wondering how best to apply a human rights framework, especially, is something I'm interested in, into our existing social movements, and make everything work a little better, more fluidly, work for everyone. So yeah, without further ado, here is that interview recorded earlier today with Loretta Ross. And you can email me with any questions also at praxis@kyrs.org. So here that is, and I'll be popping back on for the second half of the hour. Thanks for listening. If you wouldn't mind starting just by introducing yourself, saying a little bit about who you are and how you ended up doing the work that you do.
Okay, my name is Loretta Ross. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I am the former national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective. And I ended up doing the work that I do because I was a rape survivor, and I was lucky enough to become the third executive director of the very first rape crisis center in the country in the 1970s. So I've been kind of like a professional feminist and human rights activist ever since.
Wow. So you founded Sister Song, and you also founded the National Center for Human Rights Education. And
yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, my transition went from women's rights to civil rights to human rights. And so I've also monitored hate groups and dealt with a number of other issues, but feel that now's our time to build a united human rights movement, bringing all the different issues together.
Yeah, and could you, for people who aren't familiar, I kind of want to define a couple things when we talk today. The idea of reproductive justice, which is a concept that you were integral in building, but also in understanding what a human rights organizing framework looks like. So,
okay,
whichever one makes the most sense for you to tackle first.
Okay. Well, first of all, reproductive justice really isn't that hard to describe. It's just hard to achieve. Well, we go beyond the pro-choice framework because we've joined it in fighting for the right not to have kids, and all individuals have the right to use birth control or abortion or abstinence if they can hold on. But we go beyond the pro-choice movement because as women of color, we have to fight equally hard for the right to have our children, to have the children that we want to have and under the conditions under which we want to have them, which means using midwives or doulas or avoiding forced cesareans, for example. Hmm. And then the third tenet of reproductive justice is the right to raise our children in safe and healthy environments. And, of course, this brings us into conversation with the other movements like the Black Lives Matters movement, or the environmental justice movement, or the anti-gentrification movement. So reproductive justice is kind of like that promiscuous concept that will sleep with anything that affects an individual's right to control their own sex and sexuality, determine if they want to have children, how they want to see their children thrive. It goes way beyond the stale debate on abortion.
Mm-hmm. And that brings up my biggest frustration with, you know, the anti-abortion movement that likes to call itself pro-life, because they appear very unconcerned with those conditions, with health access, with education access, safe neighborhoods, good food, once children exist.
Yeah, they seem to not care about the kids once they're here.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's not just the right to control your own fertility, but quite often, those external conditions even determine whether or not you're ready to parent or not. Because a lot of people want to make sure that they have a good environment for their children, health care, that they have jobs, that they have educational opportunities. And if those things are lacking, that may dissuade someone from keeping a wanted pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And so we believe reproductive justice is a much more logical and human rights-based approach to looking at these issues and really focusing on individuals' human rights so that they can express their sex and their sexuality in the way that's most comfortable for them.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful framework, I think. What does it look like on the ground? What does it look like as a movement? What has it looked like, and what is it looking like in the future?
Well, first of all, let's talk about what human rights are, because usually when people think about human rights, they think about the tortured prisoner in a jail OC somewhere. But human rights are really our own deal with our own government. I mean, there's civil rights, the right to be equal to anybody else in society, political rights like freedom of speech, the right to vote, though we don't have our right to have our votes counted, so says the Supreme Court. Economic human rights, which is what the Occupy movement has called attention to, that the economy is definitely being managed for the benefit of the 1%, not the 99%. So we have a right to living wage. We have a right to economic benefits of our society. We're the richest country in the world, but most of us are not benefiting from that. And I think that's what's animating a number of people to support somebody like Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's social human rights, which is about your human needs, your right to food, shelter, education, health care, cultural human rights, which of course is your right to practice the religion of your choice. So freedom of religion is a human right. But we as feminists also maintain that freedom from religion is a human right. I have the human right to not have someone else's religion imposed upon my body.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, it kind of frustrates me because so many of these proselytizers for religion can't even get the people of their own faith to obey them. And then they're trying to make the rest of us go along with the program. And then there's environmental human rights, the right to clean water, non-toxic neighborhoods. Those are very important rights, you know, the right to a clean environment. And then developmental rights is the one that's harder to describe. But what we used to call the developing world or the third world is now called the global south. And they're demanding the right to control their own natural resources and really are protesting our willingness to go to war to secure their oil for our own uses. And then the eighth category is called sexual human rights, which is, of course, one of my favorites because it's about the right to determine if and when you have sex, if and when you marry, if and when you have kids, and, of course, the right to sexual pleasure. And so when, because reproductive justice rests on this capacious human rights framework, we feel that it goes far beyond arguing for privacy, because some things the government must not do to us, like tell us how to worship or tell us how to vote or tell us what to say. But at the same time, government has an obligation to us to provide a healthcare system, an educational system, an economic system where we can find jobs, those kinds of things. Sexual rights are called negative and positive rights in human rights parlance. But basically, we feel that we should use the global human rights framework in the United States, bring human rights home.
Yeah, and where, this is kind of a leading question, where do you think we're at in terms of the United States? How close are we to that in this country today?
Well, we're pretty far away from it because of the more than 2 dozen human rights treaties that are available to be ratified by the Senate, and it only takes a 2/3 majority of the Senate, not the Congress, but the Senate, to ratify a treaty. We've only ratified 3 of 26 treaties. And so we practice what's called American exceptionalism. We believe that we're too good to live by the rules that the rest of the world lives by. Which is a bit arrogant on our part, probably a lot arrogant on our part. So, for example, we have not ratified the Women's Human Rights Treaty, the Children's Human Rights Treaty, the Environmental Treaties, the Weapons of Mass Destruction Treaties. I mean, there's so many things we just refuse to do for a legitimate fear, because once we do those things, then Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution says that treaty law is the same as federal law. So if we ratified these treaties, we have to change our laws to comply with them. And so the Senate is very stubborn in failing to ratify international treaties because they don't want to be compliant with them. But I think they do a disservice to the American people. And we're out of step with the International Human Rights Community, even though we brazenly use the phrase that we're a human rights-based country. But in many ways, we're failing our people in terms of protecting their human rights, whether it's access to a free education or universal health care, or just even having the economy managed so that jobs aren't being outsourced, that we don't just have minimum wage jobs, living wage jobs. But the problem we have is that the American people as a whole don't know their human rights. And if you don't know your human rights, you can't fight for your human rights. And so I actually think it's a conspiracy that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is over 60 years old, and most of the American public has never even heard of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even as an activist and someone who's been engaged in this world, I wasn't exposed to it for many years, you know, after I probably should have been being in that world, let alone just in normal life. And there's even, I wonder, there's something I wanted to ask you about a little bit later on, but how do you think we can approach, just in our culture, there's a big, loud, noisy movement on the right that says, basically, you don't have a right to anything. You're not born with a right to anything. You're not entitled, you know, trying to, how do you engage that and kind of clarify that for people in a way that's effective?
Well, I'm not so sure they're opposed to human rights. They just want to reserve them for a small part of the population themselves. I love it when they say we want to keep the government out of our Medicare. It's just amazing that they understand that they deserve entitlements and benefits, but they tend to accuse anybody who's not just like them, meaning white, heterosexual, Christian, etc., as undeserving of human rights, as if we're not human or something. So I don't know if these people that I'm talking about have ever been exposed to the concept of universal human rights, or if they have just been seduced into a narrative that says that they're the makers of America and we're the takers of America, because that's what the Republicans have been droning in their heads for the last 50 years. And so, and of course, the election of President Obama just confirmed for them that they were losing white privilege in their own society, which is not true, but that's what they believe. So they're using the politics of anger and the politics of rage. And you're seeing it erupting violently at Trump rallies, and the openness of the racism and the homophobia and the sexism in a way that I think some of us are surprised by in the 21st century, because we like to think that we had buried some of that stuff in the 20th century. We certainly fought a civil war over racial equality, and yet we still seem to be fighting that same war over and over and over again. And so I don't try to speak to the leaders of the hate movement, and I consider, you know, Donald Trump one of those leaders, mm-hmm. but I am concerned about his followers, because I think there are people who are damaged by our neoliberal economy who are being left out of the benefits of America, and they're taking their grievances out on other victims instead of seeing how the whole system is rigged to disenfranchise them, to exploit their unemployment and their labor, and to keep us all down. And all we can do is try to call them in to our understanding of how we need to unite to turn the situation around.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted. That was my favorite part. I was at your talk in Spokane on International Women's Day, and was just scribbling furiously, because I loved what you said about calling in instead of calling out. Just as a, you know, movement person, it can be really divisive just among people who you would think would be on the same side. So could you maybe summarize that idea for listeners about calling in versus calling out, what you mean by that?
Well, if we're going to build this united human rights movement, we're going to have to bring people together who don't necessarily agree together, but they agree to be together. That, to me, is really important. If I think working on women's issues is the most important thing to do, and you think working on the environment or voting rights or youth issues or LGBTQ issues, then we can still all sit at the table, and I can be the women's wing of the human rights movement while you're the queer rights wing of the human rights movement and the environmental justice wing of the same movement. So if we share the human rights framework, we can call each other in instead of calling each other out for not being politically or racially or sexually or ethnically in the same place as we are. It is busting apart the whole concept of identity politics that is being misused to only develop kinship networks, not actually talking about what we have in common as human beings.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then that extends even in, I would think that we would kind of have to start at home, as it were, start with people who are already on more of the same page, moving that way, and then reach out a little further.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, because what happens a lot in progressive circles is that, I think it's typified by the Hillary Sanders split. Mm-hmm. How we call each other out for not agreeing with us on which candidates to support, instead of you realizing that at some point we're going to have to unite to keep the forces of fascism down. But some people would rather lose and be what they think is right than win if they have to compromise. That's what the Republicans have done for the last two administrations to Obama. And I don't think the left profits from embarking on that same kind of self-destructive strategy.
Yeah. And how, when there is such, there are still legitimate divides there, right? In understanding and everything. How do you think we start to introduce this kind of framework? Or how have you started to introduce it in, you know, sectors of the movement that you've worked in when we're pretty far
right
from that
now,
in some ways?
Right now I'm organizing a calling in the Calling Out Culture Forum up here in the Pioneer Valley, involving the schools of Hampshire College, Smith College, Amherst, Mount Holyoke, and the University of Massachusetts, so that 150 students learn techniques on how to call each other in. And the techniques are not that hard to learn. Like, if you hear somebody use a word that you don't agree with, like, oh, that's retarded, you can approach that person privately and say, you know, when you use that word retarded, I don't necessarily agree with the word, because now we say mentally disabled and you may have inadvertently hurt somebody. But calling out is a public performance where you're condemning somebody for not using the right word and not using the right pronoun or not having the same position that you have on any number of issues. Where calling in is more of a private act, where you do it one-on-one. You try to interrogate what they meant by what they said, whether or not you could offer them a new understanding of what they meant to say, or you could just accept that they meant what they said and be okay with that. Because it's not, again, putting pressure on people to agree with each other, but seeing what you have in common so that you can be with each other. And so much of our radical consciousness has been translated into rude behaviors, which is really antithetical to building a human rights movement. Because the only qualification for being in the human rights movement that you have is to be human. And so I'm not saying that we have to give passes to people who abuse us or commit violence against us, because that should be called out. But at the same time, we can't define every offense we experience as violence. So somebody used the wrong word. Well, that's just them using the wrong word. That's not violence. That's not a trigger. That's not a microaggression. That's just them using the wrong word. And so we have to shift our consciousness and say, first of all, what is our prize? Let's keep our eyes on the prize. We want to build a human rights movement. That's going to require us to call people in and sit down and have respectful conversations about our differences that can unite us versus using those differences to divide us. That's a new strategy for organizing that I don't think we have a lot of experience in, but in 1968, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King called on us to build a human rights movement, but he was assassinated 4 days later. Mm-hmm. And so we're just now getting to the understanding of what will that actually mean. Can we all sit down at the table, even though we're working with different understandings from different identity places, with different politics, but understand that the fate of the earth is at risk, the fate of our country is at risk, and mostly the fate of our friends and our families are at risk, and we really need to do something different. Right now, we don't even know how to have a respectful conversation with the drunk uncle at Thanksgiving who says something that says that he's a Trump supporter, you know, without blowing up the entire Thanksgiving dinner
mm-hmm.
with their opinion about what's wrong with Donald Trump.
Ooh, yeah.
I mean, there's things we can do better if we become more humble, if we recognize that people are entitled to their opinions no matter how wrong they are, and that you can use love as a way to call people in rather than anger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that takes so much personal inner work that I think has been rejected by a lot of people because it sounds really fluffy. You know, it sounds like this kind of new age, like, oh, you know, change yourself. But a lot of that has been cast by the wayside, and I think it has value, you know, to...
But I don't think it's a new age, because in the 1960s, Reverend Dr. Joseph Lowery, who's an icon of the civil rights movement, and maybe I have an advantage because I'm in Atlanta, the birthplace of civil rights, I get to hear my elders talk all the time. And Reverend Lowery said, we need to learn how to turn to each other instead of on each other. and he said that in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's new age. I think that's the way you craft a winning coalition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I just think the way that it's been presented at times, people think, oh, that doesn't sound strategic. That doesn't sound... And it's also, you know, this is me coming out of somewhere that's really overwhelmingly white, really has a lot of those institutional behaviors and beliefs that are built out of that and are built out of individualism and all of that. So hearing things like that, people think, that's not going to work, you know. So I think we're coming back around.
I get that, but they learned the wrong lessons from the civil rights movement and from the women's rights movement. I mean, the women's movement is not everybody being in the same organization with groupthink. The women's movement is a lot of different organizations with as many definitions of feminism as there are feminists. But at the same time, we're a movement because we have many different ideas moving in the same direction. Whereas if you have one idea moving in the same direction, you're a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not trying to build a cult, but we're using cult-like behaviors when we call each other out. We're not using movement-building behaviors. And so I think as an elder in the movement, I have a rare opportunity to offer insight from my elders and pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that hopefully makes sense. Now, I do love Gloria Steinem's quote when somebody asked her when she was going to pass the torch. She said, get your own torch. I'm just still using mine. And so that's kind of how I feel. I still have work to do with my own torch, but I am very willing to build that bridge and pass on the hard-earned learnings that I've gotten, both from my elders and from 45 years of doing this movement work.
Mm-hmm. And I love talking to people like you are my favorite people to talk to on this show who have that experience, but then are still engaged, who aren't, you know, you're not detached from it now, reminiscing about the old days, you're still in it. And I wonder what are your observations about kind of the intergenerational dynamics of what's going on right now? What do you see in this up and coming generation that's good? And maybe what advice would you have for what we haven't quite got figured out yet?
Okay, well, what I see as good is that younger people have advantages that will really lend themselves towards building this human rights movement. First of all, they're almost preternaturally intersectional. They delight in having multiple identities that they keep together within their souls, so they're not going to be sliced into the women's movement or the queer movement or the disability rights movement. They want to be all those things at the same time. Well, that's a perfect platform for which to talk about human rights, because we have to build a movement where you can be all those things at the same time, rather than being simply identity-based formations. The other advantage they have is technology, the way that they're able to use social media to reach unprecedented numbers and to do mobilizations and to pass on consciousness in a way that we didn't have. I mean, we had print, we had newspapers and radio shows, but certainly without the reach of the current social media. So they have that advantage. I think a disadvantage that they have is that, number one, I think the media tells them that somehow they don't need to listen to elders because we're old school, we don't understand their reality, almost as if we've never been young, you know? And so the media foments quite a bit of intergenerational angst that I think is just unnecessary. I also think that in a way, they have conflated things like abuse, offense, violence, and triggers. They can't necessarily accurately assess a threat level, so that when something offends them, they think by definition it means violence. Well, no, violence has its own characteristic, and it usually involves a physical dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone says something that's offensive to me, I'm going to respond differently than if someone threatens my life. But somehow that gets conflated for young people, so that if someone disagrees with them, you just raped my consciousness. No, I challenge your consciousness. But to use an overly strong word like rape means that, first of all, you don't actually know what rape is. And secondly, that you're over-dramatizing what is actually just a philosophical or political difference. And so I want them to be able to assess threat levels better, because we do have real enemies out here in the personification of Trump followers and Donald Trump in particular, and even, you know, some of the more mild-mannered, mild-seeming people who are opposed to human rights. And so we need to understand that from the 60s and the COINTEL program, one of the things that they used to disrupt radical movements was the performance of calling each other out. They would gossip about each other. They would, you know, disagree on philosophical points and then oust people for not agreeing with them, and isolate people and really become quite cultish in their behaviors because of that external threat of being infiltrated by the state. Well, right now, we really have to become much more sophisticated in analyzing these threat levels. Otherwise, we become even more vulnerable to being disrupted by the forces that are hostile to what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. We need to learn to call each other in so that we can accurately identify people who refuse to be called in because they're there for a whole nother reason.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, because that's what I've... So I've been doing this show for 4 years, talking to people about doing social justice, organizing, and what works specifically. And over the last couple of years, it's really been moving toward this idea of vulnerability, being expressive, being authentic, being open, which is all of what you're talking about, which is why I wanted to talk to you. Do you think that there is a risk that opens up when you make your movements transparent and open and vulnerable in that sort of way and not cultish? You know, if it was developed as a protective armor, do we still need that? And what do you think there's a downside? I'm not saying that there is, but...
Well, obviously, we become much more vulnerable as we become much more transparent, but we also become much more authentic when we become transparent. I think that there are risks to doing coalitional work because you're going to have to be brave. You're going to have to speak up. You're going to have to move out of your comfort zone. But let's be clear, if being oppressed is not safe, why do we think fighting oppression should be safe?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense, because we're up against some of the most inimical forces in the world trying to end this sea of oppression, this toxic sea of oppression that we all swim in. And so it requires a different kind of bravery, and it may not be something everybody's ready to do, because if you're in the midst of your trauma, you know, you may not be in an emotional space so that you can work to call somebody in. You may need healing before you can get there. So it's not for everybody. But for those of us who have processed our trauma and want to use it as ammunition for building a movement, I do believe that we have an opportunity to build a new movement for the 21st century. I would like to see the 21st century to be the century of human rights and not the century of war. We had that in the 20th century, and I am so ready to get over the Civil War and all the Cold War and culture wars, and just move into how can we use the benefits of our planet and our technology and our knowledges to build a better future for humanity. Mm-hmm. That's what I really want us to do. And that's not kumbaya. I think that's survival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Loretta, thank you so much for joining me. Keep up the good
work. Okay, and I hope you send me a tape of your program, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
I look forward to it. Bye-bye.
If you're just joining me at the end of that interview there, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thinner Community Radio. That was an interview I recorded this morning with Loretta Ross, reproductive justice activist, human rights organizer, educator, and much more. You can find more about her work and her at Loretta Ross, LORETTAROSS.com, LorettaRoss.com. I'll also post that link in the podcast notes, which you can find by finding my show page on KYRS.org or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Praxis Radio. So there's so much of that interview, so much of her talk. As I said, she came to keynote speak at the International Women's Day event this last Saturday. There's so much of that that I kind of want to pull out and take apart and work with. And I think that is something that will be happening over the next month or so on this show. But something I wanted to share that Loretta shared at the event that we didn't have time to get to in the interview. I just love that closing part where she's talking about learning to be more sophisticated about assessing threats. I think that people who do work on social justice and do work on activism and organizing and such are in this kind of permanently defensive state. And maybe, I mean, a lot of people are in a permanently defensive state, right? And there are real threats in the world, but assessing who to trust and who to not trust and when to, you know, stay calm and when to react is a real thing to develop. And it's something that, you know, that's a journey that I've been on over the past decade or so of doing this work, especially going through periods of like incredible rage all the time, permanent rage of realizing, you know, the extent to which you've been lied to and who can you trust and nobody understands what's going on. And she shared a framework in which we understand the people working with us in coalitions or just in our lives, in our families, in our friendships on a spectrum from people who are co-conspirators, which is a term that I've also shared on this show, I think in an interview with Lucy Duncan, who's a Quaker activist working in Philadelphia, who I met this summer, she said she prefers that term to allies because it sounds like more of an active role. It's more of a partnership. It's less of a I support you. It's a we support one another in building something together. So co-conspirators, those are the people who pretty much have your back all the time, who you share an understanding with and are able to work with and comfort. Your allies, who are people who you have at least enough in common to come to the table together, as Loretta said in that interview, not necessarily stand for everything with, but go in the same general direction. Problematic allies, who might be people I've had a lot of these in my life. Problematic allies, you know, people who are on board, but maybe are disruptive in certain group scenarios, who haven't worked out their own stuff, think that their issue is the issue, and maybe fail to understand intersectionality in certain ways, you know, to see why their specific campaign relates to broader movements, but maybe also want to refocus broader movements on their specific campaign. That's an example I would give of problematic allies. Occasionally hostile persons. I don't know if this is exactly how Loretta framed it. This is what my notes ended up saying. Occasionally hostile persons and permanently hostile persons. And that just hearing those categories from co-conspirator to permanently hostile person, everyone I know who does organizing work in the room was just laughing to themselves a little bit and discussed it with quite a few people since then. I like that framework because it gives us kind of a spectrum that we can orient ourselves on when you're in a situation with someone who is difficult and you might be tempted to, you know, and I don't know how specific this is to people, but you might be tempted to call them out or kick them out and say, we can't work on this together because fill in the blank, you don't understand some structural oppression or you don't understand this issue that I want to work on. Locating where that person is in terms of that spectrum. If they're a permanently hostile person who, you know, doesn't play well with others as a matter of principle or personality, you know, probably not a person you need in your coalition. And that's okay. We're at this interesting nexus, I think. This is my assessment of Spokane culturally. And yeah, because that's where I'm rooted. But in the social justice community here, I think we're at this toxic nexus of this cultural idea of being nice and being polite. That's very much part of our culture. Not rocking the boat, not upsetting people, being non-confrontational, and feeling isolated as people who are radical or progressive in a fairly homogenous, fairly conservative place. That nexus creates this culture where people accept the idea that there's only a few dozen people who care about social justice and human rights in my area, and that's it. And I guess we'll just make do with what we have, which, you know, I think is pretty ridiculous personally, and a lot of other people I've talked to, and especially doing the show and meeting so many people who are directly involved in it, who I've never met before, but they've been working this whole time, you know. I think I bought into that idea for a long time before getting kind of a broader exposure to what's going on. And I think those phenomena support each other in ways that do not serve us well, and contribute to kind of preemptive calling out almost. So I have some more resources on this idea. I didn't know if calling in was a specific Loretta Ross turn of phrase invention, and it is not. And it's something that I've found a couple articles that I really like about that I'm going to share with you. I think that it's important to be critical of internal movement culture, especially as people who are working kind of on the long haul on issues that are intersectional, as this movement gains more momentum and more interest and more affirmation from the culture at large in like presidential election year, for instance, you know, Bernie Sanders' campaign being a huge example of someone who's talking about these issues, who's getting a ton of people excited about, you know, progressive to potentially radical politics, but more on the progressive end, and figuring out how to, you know, protect movements from these fracturing phenomenon, but also not getting, I don't know, yeah, finding that balance. So I'm going to let some intelligent people help me with this through a couple different essays that I found. Lo Antran on blackgirldangerous.org wrote a piece that is like widely cited about this called Calling In, a Less Disposable Way of Holding Each Other Accountable. I'm going to hop in to their piece about halfway through and share portions of it with you, and I'll link to the full piece because I really like it. The second piece that I'm going to share with you is also references this piece, so I'm going to read it first. They say, I don't propose practicing calling in opposition to calling out. I don't think that our work has room for binary thinking and action. However, I do think it's possible to have multiple tools, strategies, and methods existing simultaneously. It's about being strategic, weighing the stakes, and figuring out what we're trying to build and how we're going to do it together. So what exactly is calling in? I've spent over a year of trying to figure this out for myself, and this practice is still coming to me daily. The first part of calling each other in is allowing mistakes to happen. Mistakes in communities seeking justice and freedom may not hurt any less, but they also have possibility for transforming the ways we build with each other for a new, better world. We have got to believe that we can transform. When confronted with another person's mistake, I often think about what makes my relationship with this person important. Is it that we've done work together before? Is it that I know their politics? Is it that I trust their politics? Are they a family member? Oh, no, my mom? I'm censoring some of this for radio. Is it that I've heard them talk about patience or accountability or justice before? Where is our common ground? And is our common ground strong enough to carry us through how we have enacted violence on each other? I start call-in conversations by identifying the behavior and defining why I'm choosing to engage with them. I prioritize my values and invite them to think about theirs and where we share them. And then we talk about it. We talk about it together, like people who genuinely care about each other. We offer patience and compassion to each other and also keep it real, ending the conversation when we need to, and know that it wasn't a loss to give it a try. Because when I see problematic behavior from someone who is connected to me, who is committed to some of the things that I am, I want to believe that it's possible for us to move through and beyond whatever mistake was committed. I picture calling in as a practice of pulling folks back in who have strayed from us. It means extending to ourselves the reality that we will and do mess up, we stray, and there will always be a chance for us to return. Calling in as a practice of loving each other enough to allow each other to make mistakes, a practice of loving ourselves enough to know that what we're trying to do here is a radical unlearning of everything we have been configured to believe is normal. And yes, we have been configured to believe it's normal to punish each other and ourselves without a way to reconcile hurt. We support this belief by shutting each other out, partly through justified anger, and often because some parts of us believe that we can do this without people who mess up. But oh no, we mess up. All of us. I've called out and been called out plenty of times. I've gotten on people ruthlessly for supporting and sustaining oppression and refusing to listen to me. People have gotten on me about speaking to oppressions that aren't mine, being superficial about inclusion, and throwing in communities I'm not part of as buzzwords. But when we shut each other out, we make clubs of people who are right and clubs of people who are wrong, as if we are not more complex than that, as if we are all-knowing, as if we are perfect. But in reality, we are just really scared. Scared that we will be next to make a mistake. So we resort to pushing people out to distract ourselves from the inevitability that we will cause someone hurt. And it is seriously draining. It is seriously heartbreaking. How we are treating each other is preventing us from actually creating what we need for ourselves. We are destroying each other. We need to do better for each other. We have to let go of treating each other like not knowing, making mistakes, and saying the wrong thing make it impossible for us to ever do the right things. And we have to remind ourselves that we once didn't know. There are infinitely many more things we have yet to know and may never know. We have got to let go of a politic of disposability. We are what we've got. No one can be left to their mess ups and the shame that comes with them, because ultimately we'll be leaving ourselves behind. I want us to use love, compassion, and patience as tools for critical dialogue, fearless visioning, and transformation. I want us to use shared values and visions as proactive measures for securing our future freedom. I want us to be present and alive to see each other change in all of the intimate ways that we experience and enact violence. I want our movement sustainable, angry, gentle, critical, loving, kicking ass, and calling each other back in when we stray. And then there's also a disclaimer at the end added by the founder and editor of Black Girl Dangerous, Mia McKenzie. She adds, disclaimer, white folks, please don't take any of this as you're okay to act a fool and expect people of color to not get angry. We have every right to get angry when you mess up, and we have no obligation whatsoever to put your hurt feelings above the impact your behavior causes. This post is specifically about us calling in people who we want to be in community with, people who we have reason to trust or with whom we have common ground. It's not a free-for-all. Thank you. Also, we are loath to have to add this disclaimer because we don't believe in focusing our energy on what white people think, on centralizing white people always, even in this queer trans people of color space. Ugh, this is why we can't have nice things. So I wanted to add that because it's another layer of this, of the complexity that we have to engage if we're going to do work like this well. If we're going to, you know, as Loretta Ross talked about in her interview, transform our society from one based on domination and oppression to one embracing a human rights framework of universal human rights, that's going to require a lot of work and a lot of learning together and unlearning, as this writer suggests also. And without that patience and compassion, it's not going to be possible. But it's also, it overlaps with this dynamic of some people being much more steeped in the reality of the oppression of the status quo than others, and therefore being demanded from, you know, problematic allies. A lot of white people in this case, working on anti-racism or just starting to understand that it exists, in that category of problematic allies, right? Who think that it's acceptable behavior to say, well, explain everything to me, person of color, like explain to me every detail of this and do it now on demand on my schedule because I just decided that it's important. So, you know, not tooling, calling in to be another layer on that for, you know, women to explain patriarchy to men, for people of color to explain racism to white people, but to be used in our own communities along that spectrum that I shared via Loretta Ross, you know, co-conspirators, allies, problematic allies, occasionally hostile persons, permanently hostile persons. It's not about, you know, engaging that necessarily random Trump violent yelling in your face Planned Parenthood protester, for instance. It's about how do you have a conversation with your aunt who maybe doesn't fully get it, but is invested in your relationship with one another and maybe will never like join the movement, as it were, but may want to have a conversation with you. So yeah, I want to share this other piece, but I'm running out of time. I might just link to it. It's Veronica Baetti Flores in Feministing on cynicism, calling out and creating movements that don't leave our people behind. And she cites the piece I just read from Black Girl Dangerous. Something I really like. Oh, where is it? Yeah, this I'll read a little bit of this because it is about cynicism. She also says that we need to let go. She says, I am so ready to let go of the America's Next Top Radical model of social justice. I think that's hilarious. So she says, so I'll jump right into the middle of her article too, and I'll link to both of these. She says, a while back, I was reading a piece somewhere I can't recall about tools of survival that no longer serve us well. Cynicism, I think, is one of these tools. For folks doing activism on the margins, women of color, queer and trans folks, sex workers, disabled folks, immigrants, those of us that fall in several or all of these or more marginalized categories, I know that our being so guarded comes from a place of being repeatedly and consistently hurt. Hurt by activism that works to further marginalize us. Hurt by projects that leave our communities behind. Hurt by good intentions that never were and never will be enough. We've become cynics in order to shield ourselves from hurt we can't afford, to not waste time on folks that never included the full liberation of our people in their agenda. We've become cynics because, in order to survive, we've had to shut some folks out. The thing is, survival is not enough. We need and deserve so much more than mere survival. We deserve to thrive. And to thrive, we have to do something scary. We have to get a little selectively vulnerable. We have to make an effort to be a little less guarded. Calling folks out in good faith or calling in is absolutely necessary. We cannot stand by as people leave the most marginalized folks in our communities out of the conversation, say things that are hurtful, and create projects that continue historical legacies of oppression. It's important not just because folks need to be educated, but because the ways we organize and the stories we tell affect the lived realities and material conditions of everyone around us. To not confront oppression when you're in a position to do so is to be complicit in its perpetuity. But it's also important to ask ourselves why we're jumping in. It's cool to be angry. I'm angry as hell, and in a world in which there's so much to hate, I tend to be a hater. But when we're trying to advance a conversation, it's important to think about what's going to be constructive. On the same tip, we need to learn how to react when being called out, how to meaningfully apologize, and how to move forward with new knowledge. To realize that making a mistake does not make us the living worst, and that we can move forward if we take critique seriously and acknowledge the serious hurt our mistakes have caused. It's hard and a consistent battle, but I don't see a way out of it. We've long been really good at critiquing and saying what we don't want, but to get a world we do want, we have to be able to dream really big. I fear that the way cynicism operates in our call-outs and activism more generally is limiting our ability to do so. How can we dream utopias if we are so afraid of being wrong? We have to be able to make mistakes, we have to experiment, we have to fail spectacularly, and we have to be able to trust that our community will let us know with tolerance when we've done so. I'm not so sure I'm all the way there yet, but I don't think there is another way. So that was Veronica Baetti Flores, part of her piece on feministing that I will share the total text of in the podcast, which you can find by going to kyrs.org to show pages Praxis, following the link there. You can also find it at facebook.com/praxisradio. I'm just about out of time. Thanks for listening. If you missed any part of that interview with Loretta Ross, again, you can find it on the podcast, which will be posted soon. This kind of wraps up. Well, we're going to have a transitional show between focusing on women's history and focusing on environmental justice, Earth Day month being April. So the vaguely thematic stream will continue next week. As always, you can email me show ideas, feedback, and the rest at praxis@kyrs.org. That's praxis@kyrs.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.